Our speaker tonight is Bob Arr.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bob, an alcoholic. Pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you, Charlie, for asking me. And I wasn't thinking about getting nervous until Judy said that. There we go. About 6 or 8 months ago, I was back in Fulton, Kentucky on a weekend. And I realized I was on a business trip, but I had stopped on the weekend to see my aunt, and it's a little town of about 10,000 people in southwestern Kentucky. So I was looking at their little weekly newspaper, and it had a sign that said it had a little ad that said Alcoholics Anonymous and an address. So I said after dinner, I said, "Would you mind if I went to an AA meeting? I'm feeling a little squeamish." And she said, "No, by all means, go ahead." So I went to the meeting and I walked in, and there were two other people there. And I said, and so we sat down, and one of them had been sober 12 years and the other one had been sober 17 years. And I said, "Who are all the people?" And they said, "This is all, we're the group." And so the three of us shared for about 15 minutes each. And after about 45 minutes, I said, "You mean there's no other AA around?" They said, "Oh, well, there's the clubhouse over there. They got, we had a big rift a few months ago, and all the people that had taken drugs in their lives split off and went over there, but we're pure alcoholics, and so we decided we'd stay here until the real Alcoholics Anonymous members showed up." And I said, "Well, I'll see you in about 12 years, we said the prayer real quick, and I finally needed the instructions, directions out of them, and I ran over to the other meeting in time to have the Lord's Prayer with those 35 other alcoholics. And it puzzled me because Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me as much as anything in my life to let go of my judging of other people. You know, I'm not saying I'm not judgmental, but it has changed my life in the sense that, you know, when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, all the things that divide us out in the world seem to just wash away. One other interesting point, it's sort of an innocent little community in Kentucky, and I said to her, "You know, one thing I really like about this place is you don't have any graffiti." And she said, "Oh, yes, we do. On the road up to Paducah," she said, "on the overpass, they got graffiti." And so the next morning, I headed out early, and I got halfway to Paducah, and I looked on the overpass, and it said, "John loves Mary." I said, "I may just move here." Anyhow, I began to drink when I was about 15 or 16 years old, and it seemed to me that up until that time, I had all of the normal frustrations of a kid. I didn't know they were normal. I thought they were only mine. I wore glasses, and I stuttered, and I was 5'10", and I wanted to be 6'4", and I was a pretty good student, and I wanted to be an intellect, so I didn't have to study. I was a pretty good athlete, and I wanted to be a great athlete, and I felt real awkward around girls, and I bit my fingernails, and I was self-conscious about that. I was self-conscious about everything. And one of the only outlets that I had was that I was sort of cocky and glib, and people didn't realize what was going on. My stomach was churning all the time. And I was embarrassed about my life. My father smoked cigars in the house, and in Massachusetts when you're growing up, you know, you close the storm windows in the end of October, and you open them, you take them down in April, and all my clothes smell like cigars, and I was embarrassed and ashamed of it. And I think I held my father guilty for a long time in the seventh grade. My teacher asked me if I smoked cigars, and I was just humiliated. Anyway, I just really didn't fit in very well at anything. And so one day after baseball practice, a friend of mine said, "Would you want to go to the park and get a couple of quarts of beer? So he looked over and he went out and bought it. And we went to the park and we started drinking those quarts of beer. And before the second quart was over, everything changed in my entire life. And the best way I had to put it one time, and I sort of just came out, I had pimples at the time, too. And when I drank those 2 quarts of beer, my pimples all cleared up. And more phenomenal than that, your pimples all cleared up, too. Just with 2 quarts of beer in me, my perception of the universe changed entirely. And I felt calm, and I fit in. And everything seemed to be, they seemed to work into society. And whenever I drank, which was as often as I could, but not very often as compared to later, it just changed things for me. I never liked the taste of alcohol, but the effect was just wondrous. It just elevated me into another plane of living that I just loved. But it didn't love me very well because I was a blackout drinker right from the start. And I would be turned into a different person. I think I'd be cute, or I think I'd be smart, or quick-witted, or whatever. It turned out I'd become sarcastic and mean, and I'd be a troublemaker. But I liked it a great deal, and since I was grounded a lot, I finally graduated from high school, and I had pretty good grades, and my parents could afford it, so I was accepted to several universities, and I was turned down by one, Dartmouth. And I know you used to talk about that, sort of a blemish on my record. But I was accepted at Notre Dame, and my parents could afford to send me there, and so I went out there for my freshman year. And when we went to Notre Dame in 1956, it was like a boot camp. And boot camp was that they locked you in the dormitories at 10 o'clock at night, and they lights out were at 11, and they didn't mean turn the lights out. They pulled the breaker. There was no more electricity. So it was like I was handcuffed. You know, I've always been worried about being handcuffed, and I've been handcuffed, and I've been in jail, and I've had warrants out for me, and I still worry about these warrants. I'll get ahead of myself a little. Later on, as a Navy officer, and I got arrested on an Air Force base one time, I was afraid to go. When I stopped drinking, I was afraid to go on a military base for fear that they'd take me in. And I was afraid to go back to Notre Dame for 20-some years because I was afraid the South Bend police still had a warrant out for me. And I was afraid to go to jails, you know, until I got involved in some H&I, and I went to jails. And they clanged those doors behind me, and it just sent a shiver up my spine. But I took those risks in sobriety because it enriched my life and enabled me to do things that I never dreamed I could do. Back to college, I got through my freshman year because I was locked in the dormitory. Got pretty good grades, and in my sophomore year, they lessened some of the restrictions, and I started drinking with a wilder crowd. And I drank continuously for the next 3 years. And ended up having to go to 3 years of summer school, but I did graduate after 4 years. And the night I graduated, I went out and got, the night I finished my last exam, I went out and got loaded, and I, loaded used to mean drunk. So I went out and got drunk. And I never took any drugs, and I don't know that, I didn't have anything against drugs, they just weren't available when I sobered up. When I was drinking, so far it's all been honest. As I mentioned, I went out and got drunk. That night they pulled me out of some hedges, and this campus policeman and this priest who was the prefect of discipline hauled me in the next morning, and they announced that I wasn't going to graduate. And I told them, you can't keep me from graduating. I completed all the courses, and besides that, my mother's on her way out on the train from Massachusetts to see me get my diploma. He assured me that she would not see me get the diploma, that I would that I was not going to graduate with my class in the commencement exercise, and that he was good for his word, because we both went back on the train to Massachusetts, and 2 or 3 weeks later, my diploma came in the mail along with a scurrilous letter that said how much of a disgrace I'd been to the university, and it went on and on, and finally he told a lie in his letter. He indicated that if I'd ever earned any money in my career, that the Alumni Association surely wouldn't be interested in me making any donations to the university. So I never sent them any. They've sent me a letter a week for 20 years, and a letter every 2 weeks, I guess, for 20 years, and I never sent them anything. And then I sent them some. Now I get a letter every week asking for more, and that's okay. And that was another place I was afraid to go back to. You know, I had a lot of fear, and I never talked too much about fear, but my life was full of fear. As I mentioned, I got out of the Navy. I was about to be drafted in the Army, I got out of college. I was about to be drafted in the Army, so I signed up for Navy OCS. They took me to Newport, Rhode Island, and they locked me up for 18 weeks. I have said before that if you lock me up and send me to medical school, I can become a brain surgeon, as long as I can't get at alcohol. But that's what they did. They locked me up for 18 weeks, and they commissioned me an officer and a gentleman, and we had a big graduation ceremony, and we threw our hats up in the air, and we all became officers and gentlemen for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, they let me go to town after that, and 10 days later, I was up for court-martial as an officer. And that's how my life had gone, and I got out of that with an Article 15, which is a little less than a court-martial, but my Navy career was tarnished after 10 days for any future promotions. And so things seemed to be going sour. My first set of, I had a guardian angel leading me through my career, my life up to that time, I just kept getting out of all these scrapes. And then I got my first set of orders out of OCS to go to Kodiak, Alaska. And I'd read all these billboards that said, join the Navy and see the world. And they have pictures of Hawaii and Bermuda and the Caribbean, the Mediterranean, and I'm going to Alaska. And I buy these real heavy wool Navy uniforms to go to Alaska. The day I get them back from the tailor, I get a change of orders to go to Asmara, Eritrea, Ethiopia, a few hundred miles north of the equator in Africa. So I went to Africa for a year and a half, and I was a disgrace to the Navy over there, but I somehow stumbled through. And I did my job more often than I acknowledge sometimes, because I did finish up there, I got a new set of orders to go back to the Pentagon. I was in the Pentagon for about 11 months, and then they completed a background investigation on me, and they checked on some of the things that I had allegedly done, and they lifted my clearance, and they farmed me out to a little Navy base right outside Washington, D.C., where I finished my tour in the Navy. At that time, I'd been dating a woman for about a year, and she consented to marry me, and so we got married a month after I got out of the Navy, and she left me no less than 40 times in the first year of marriage, all due to my drinking and my behavior before, during, and after my drinking. I was fired from 3 jobs in that first year, and finally on the 3rd or 4th job, they transferred me out here to California. She heard that I was coming, and so she jumped on the bandwagon, and out we came. I drank in Southern California for another year and a half, and during that year and a half, I averaged driving the freeways in a blackout no less than 3 or 4 nights a week. I would wake up in my bed in Van Nuys with no recollection of anything except sitting in a bar in Alhambra the previous evening at 5:30, and no recollection of anything between. January 1967, my life was just a shambles. I got fired from my job. My wife was 9 months and 4 days pregnant, and I threw her out of the house the night before she went in the hospital to give birth to my oldest daughter, and they couldn't find me the next day, and they finally came and flushed me out and took me to the hospital, and I was there when she was born, and I made a vow that I'd never take another drink. But then I said, it's 3:30 in the afternoon, or 4:30 in the afternoon on Sunday, and I haven't been to Mass yet, so I want to go to 5 o'clock Mass. So I drove up to the church, and I parked the car in the parking lot, and I walked across the street and down the block, and I went in and had 5 doubles. And I walked back, and forgetting about my vow never to drink again, but unable to do anything about it. I drank for another 16 days, and then on January 24th, 1967, I was 28 years old, and I couldn't go any further. My sponsor for 16 years said it best. He said the bottle had beat me to death, and I had run out of my own resources, and I couldn't go on another day. And so I threw in the towel, and I went over and saw a priest that I had known in Malibu, and he sent me to a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she took me to my first meeting at the Arlington Group. And a week later, I didn't go to another meeting for a week, but I read the book and I talked to the people on the phone. And the next Tuesday night, we went back and I heard Norm Alpie speak. And it changed my life. And I'm sure Norm Alpie has affected some of your lives. If some of you people never heard Norm Alpie, you ought to make it a point to get a hold of one of his tapes and listen to that magical man who was so full of love and enthusiasm. When I was sober 10 or 12 days or something like that, they suckered me into going on a couples retreat, and I went and met some people from the San Fernando Valley where I lived, and they introduced me to a big Friday night speaker meeting in the West San Fernando Valley. And I became instantly active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to 5 or 6 meetings a week. When I came in, I wore a big head. I was a fat man then, and I'm not a fat man now. But I wore a big black raincoat, and I had a scowl on my face and a chip on my shoulder, and I didn't want to. I didn't want anybody to come up to me, and this black raincoat sort of protected me. It was like my security blanket, and I wore it everywhere I went. You know, it was black when I came to AA, but it had started out as olive green, and it had sweat rings under the arms, and I felt so secure and so comfortable and safe with it. And I wore it all the time. And when I first came to AA, I met this Father Ted, who was a Catholic priest. He'd been sober 7.5 years. And that Friday night meeting, he said, I need a ride home. And so I said, I'll take you home. By then I only repossessed my car, but by then I'd gotten it back. And so I said, I'll take you home. So I took him home and dropped him off. And he said, I need to ride to Burbank at noon tomorrow. So I said, I'll take you to Burbank. So I took him to Burbank and as I dropped him off after the meeting, he said, I want to talk to you in my room tonight. So I went over and I talked to him in his room. And then the next morning, went back to Burbank to the meeting, and that night to the Rolling Stag meeting, and on and on. We went to 17 meetings in 14 days. And something happened in my life. Here I was 2 or 3 weeks sober, and I'd become somebody. I'd become Father Ted's driver, a celebrity in Alcoholics Anonymous. There, 4 weeks before, I'd been standing at the door of the Dora Gold at Fulton and Van Owen at 6:05 every morning, waiting for it to open. And now I'm Father Ted's driver, and I'm a big shot in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time I'd go to a meeting, we'd walk in, and they'd have a seat for Father Ted and a seat for me. And everybody'd say, hi, Father Ted, and hi, Bob, and I just felt great. And after the 17th meeting and the 14th day, I dropped him off, and I said, same time tomorrow, Father? And he says, no. He says, I got another ride. And I said to myself, you ungrateful old ghost. You know, here I've been saving his life for 2 weeks and doing all this, going out of my way to do all this, and he dumps me like that. And it was ironic because that next night, my wife at the time was pacing, and about 8 o'clock that next night, and she said, are you going to the meeting? And I said, no. And about 10 after 8, I couldn't take it any longer, and I just got up and went to the meeting. And I walked in there, and there's Father Ted sitting in his seat, and his new ride sitting in my seat. And I walk across the room, and there's 3 old-timers been sober 9 months, 13 months, something like that. And I walk over to them, and before I can open my mouth, one of them said to me, we get it to you too, huh? At Father Ted's funeral 10 years ago, I guess Chuck was probably there, there must have been 1,500 former Father Ted drivers coming from all over the country, you know, to celebrate this man's life and all that he did for Alcoholics Anonymous. But he gave me, the reason for the story is that he gave me the legacy of going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. He taught me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I go to AA meetings today when I feel bad. And I go to meetings when I feel good. And I go to meetings when I'm not feeling anything. You know, I probably average 3 or 4 AA meetings a week for 27.5 years, and I probably go to as many now as I did 15 years ago. We moved 3 days before the earthquake from the San Fernando Valley out to Oxnard Shores, and it was nice to get out of there, but it still shook a lot. And I got out there, and I said to myself, and I sort of just hibernated, you know. I was always critical of these people that would move somewhere and then come back to our home group and say, oh, the meetings aren't as good where I moved, you know. I need to come back here, travel all the way back here so I can see some real Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got out there and I started going to those meetings and I found myself with the same attitude. And I was too ashamed to admit that I'm thinking, the meetings just aren't, they're just not as good as they were in the valley where I'm accustomed to going. And I used to come down here for the last year. Tonight we went over to have dinner before the meeting, and I used to bring Ben once every 6 weeks or 8 weeks. I'd come pick up Ben, and I'd bring him, and we'd go out to dinner, and we'd sit down front. And I loved him, and I missed him tonight when we went to dinner. Dinner wasn't the same without him. And he was a dear, gentle man. All my life, I've been wanting to be a gentle man. You know, some people have commented to me, well, you are a gentleman. But I never felt like a gentleman. You know, I felt like a competitive, hard-driving, go-getting, you know, like I'm just trying to struggle and survive. And I never, when I was around Ben, I felt gentle. My first sponsor in AA was Warren Snyder, and very few of you know who he was, but he was a gentle, kind man, and I admired that so much in him. Well, as I mentioned, when I got in AA, I got a sponsor, and then I got another sponsor, and I got active in the program. When I was 6 months sober, when I was 2 weeks sober, I got a job. And when I was 6 months sober, they made me secretary of one of the participation meetings, the men's stag. When I was a year sober, they elected me secretary at a big speaker meeting out in the valley. It was the biggest meeting in the valley. It's now Mason and Lassen, and four or five other meetings have spun off from it. But I felt like a celebrity in AA. Here I'm a year sober, and I had just gotten another job. I'd been fired from that job. I didn't like that feeling. In fact, in Alcoholics Anonymous, my track record, if you took a look at what's happened to me since I sobered up, you'd say this guy's got a sort of a mediocre career going, you know. But I was fired the day I came into AA, or the day before. I stayed with a job for a year and got fired again. Got another job. 10 months later, I got fired again. So I went out and got a good job, and I did a good job at it. And I kept it for 5 years. And they even sent me to the American Management Association School for Sales Managers and told me I was going to become a sales manager. And that this was I lived here, and this was the territory where I was going to be the manager. I was convinced of it. And so they fired my boss, who was the manager. And they brought in a guy from Milwaukee to replace him. And here I'm still a salesman. And I said to myself, I've been the top salesman for the last 5 years in this territory. They can't fire me. 3 months later, they fired me. 7 years sober, I've been fired 3 times. I said, screw this. There must be a message here somewhere. I started my own business, and I've had my own business for the last 20 years. And I got fired once, but it wasn't really the same. Sort of hard. When you got your own business, whether it's good or bad, you can say you got your own business. You're really not up for being fired. But that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. It's enabled me to be fired into prosperity. And Chuck C. was my sponsor for 16 years. Warren Snyder died after a couple of years sober, and Warren and Chuck C. was my sponsor for the next 20 years. And he used to tell me stories. He told us all stories. He told little parables, you know. And he talked to me one time about what it was. I guess what he was talking about was God. He was talking about what Alcoholics Anonymous is and what love is. And he said there was this little fish that was swimming in the ocean. Just one morning, the little fish was just swimming around, and the big fish swam by. And the big fish said, isn't the water nice today? And the little fish, and he swam off. And the little fish looked at him and said to himself, what's water? And he swam all over the ocean looking for water, and he never found water. And I thought to myself, the little fish couldn't find water in which he lived and moved and had his being. Some days I say, where's God, you know? And God is... And I'm living in God. I see God out here in how many hundreds of faces. And I feel God. And that's how it is. You know, I live and move and have my being when I am in God with you people. I forgot where I was. Now I know what you mean, Judy. Anyhow, I kept getting fired, as I mentioned, but I stayed active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got involved in intergroup, stayed with that for a couple of years, and then I got involved in general service and stayed involved in that. And all of my old ideas that I seemed to have in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought to myself, you know, I really don't have time to get involved in H&I. And then one day a man called me from Long Beach, his name was Bill, and he said, I'm going up to Tehachapi, and I'd like you to go with us. So I went up with him. and a couple of times, I guess, and I enjoyed the meeting, and I enjoyed the companionship, and I enjoyed the people in the prisons. And all my life, I'd always, you know, I had a sort of conservative idea about things just because that's the way I was raised. And I believe in capital punishment. I just figured if you did the thing, you deserved the punishment. Capital punishment was okay. And a friend of mine said, I've got a panel up at San Luis Obispo at the men's colony, and I can't do it. So will you take it for the next year? And so once every month or two for the next year, I got a group together, and we went up, and we put on a meeting for the prisoners up there. And this was the maximum security place. And this is where I felt squeamish when they clanged the door behind the gate behind me. Then I walked into the next section, they clanged another one. After about the third one, you were in. And there was no getting out in a hurry. And I was nervous about it. And I went into that meeting, and I went up to that prison with the same conviction that if you do the thing, that, you know, capital punishment is okay. It's what you deserve. And after the second or third time I came walking out of there, everything in my belief system changed. I hugged these people. I held their hands and I shared with them, and they shared with me. And we cried together and we laughed together. And then I got to leave, and they stayed there. And I thought to myself, there's no way that I could believe in taking a human life. And that's just something that happened to me. As I mentioned, I went to Notre Dame, and I had this bad feeling of it. See, a guy had the audacity to wear a USC sweatshirt in here tonight. But I had this bad feeling about USC. You know, they started beating us when I was a freshman in college, and they beat us for year after year after year, and it just was humiliating, and I just really didn't like them. And that band in particular, you know, where they wear all that armor, and they strut around and do that. And I was back at Notre Dame about 6 or 8 years ago, and this band is you know, they look so powerful and so arrogant, and it just pissed me off. And after the game, I walked down, and I was walking up the thing, and the band was standing beside me. And I looked behind these helmets and shields, and they're little children. They're 18 and 19 and 20-year-old boys and girls. And I felt like taking them in my arms and holding them. And I thought to myself, what? You know, this is amazing. And now I have my own business. And a year ago, we're trying to make the business grow. And so a year ago, I went and saw my cousin, who was an executive in the business. And I said, I need to get some help. And he said, well, what I always did, I went to Loyola Marymount, and they had an MBA field study program. And they would give you a bunch of several students and a professor. And they would analyze your business and come up with a business plan. So I had one of these men that works for me, who's also a member of AA. I said, get in touch with the schools around here. So I got in touch with Pepperdine and UCLA and Loyola Marymount and a couple of others. And about a month and a half ago, I got a reply. Somebody accepted us. USC. So 2 weeks ago, a week ago last Friday, I had to go down there. And the man was making an announcement of all the companies that were participating in this year's field study projects. And he mentioned all the different companies, and he mentioned our company. And then he said, to let you people all know, there are hundreds of people in this room, and they're from big corporations. And he said, just to let you people know how open-minded we are, we even got Bob Regan from such and such company, who's a graduate of Notre Dame. And you know what? When I walked on that campus, I had that same feeling that they're going to put me in handcuffs for all the bad feelings that I had about this place. And then I got my little badge. I showed it to Pat before the meeting. That's what reminded me. And they even gave me a sweatshirt. Now, I only told you about the sweatshirt because Vince wasn't here tonight. So, with a big Trojan and a USC and NBA underneath it, sort of feels good having that sweatshirt. So, in any case, I don't know how I got off on that. When I was in Ethiopia, I decided to take some R&R, rest and recreation. So I rented an army jeep, and we headed down to the boondocks. And we loaded up with beer and whiskey. And so I'm driving this jeep, drinking beer. We're way down in the tulis of Ethiopia. We're going to hunt, and we're going to just, you know, go off and be by ourselves. And we got so much deer and all this, and we're driving along having a ball, and I'm driving down, and we pass this little family, and there's a mother and a father and a boy on one side, a 9-year-old girl on the other side. So then we're driving along, and they're walking the same way we're driving. And as we drove up beside them, just before we got to them, the little girl looked, startled, jumped up in the air, and ran right into the side of the Jeep. And she just crumbled. And I stopped the Jeep, and I picked her up, and I put her family in the Jeep, and we drove to the little village, and it was like MASH. They had one of those open-air tents, and nobody spoke English, and they sort of worked her over a little bit, and finally she regained consciousness. And I went into the next little town the next day, and we reported it. And when I got back to the city, I talked to this Italian insurance company, and they assured me that it's no big deal, just don't worry about it. Well, it was a big deal to me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was an amends that I didn't know how I'd make. This was 8,000 miles away, and it had happened several years before, and it gnawed at me. But finally, after talking to my sponsors, I came to a conclusion that there was just nothing I could do to make amends to her. So that would be an amends that would go unmade. When I was about 9 years sober, my wife at the time said to me, we want to get my oldest daughter at the time, by then I had another daughter, involved in a little girl softball league. And all the parents have to go to the first meeting. So I went to the meeting and said, we don't collect much money, so all the parents have to volunteer. I went out and hit them some grounders, and the coach of the team asked me if I'd be his assistant coach. The Pearls chose the name of the team based on the color of their uniforms that they drew. They drew purple, and I became the assistant coach of the Purple Panthers in the Little Girls Softball League. And by then I'd had my own business. I'd been fired into my own business, and so I had a little time in my hands. And so I started coaching the Purple Panthers. And our little clumsy girls were a little better than some of the other clumsy girls. We won all six of our exhibition games. And then after the exhibition games, we won our first three games in the regular season. And here we are, 9-0. And I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if they ever elected an assistant coach into their Hall of Fame. And my ego was blossoming. And by that time, it looked, on the outside, everything looked good. And that year, I was the co-chairman of the AA Southern California Convention. And I was an active guy, and I was owned my own business, and things looked good on the outside. And in the inside, these Purple Panthers were churning up my stomach because they lost a game, and then they won a game, and they lost another game. They ended up the end of the first half of the season in second place, and I didn't like second place. And then the woman at the break, we had as soon as the first half ended, this woman manager on our team, who was really the boss, came up to me and she said, the women managers are having a meeting next Tuesday. And I said, what for? She said, to throw you out of the league. And I said, what do you mean, throw me? What have I done? She said, well, they say you got everybody scared. The umpires are afraid of you. The other coaches are afraid of you. The girls are pretending to be sick on the days they have a game. They're not wanting to come to practice. And she went on and on and on. And I frightened all these people to the point where nobody wanted to be around the league or me. And just as I thought she was finished, the woman, one of the mothers on our team, who was the biggest loudmouth in the league, came up and put her finger right on the end of my nose. And she says, and you got a big mouth. And I wanted to just plow them both under and go straight to prison in Idaho for 20 years. And I didn't, and the words came out of my mouth, weren't my words. I said, Ann, apparently the thing that's been bothering everybody else is the same thing that's been bothering me, and I didn't know what it was. And what's bothering you and bothering me is Bob Regan. And you go back and have your meeting and tell him that now that I know I'm the problem, I'm going to try to change. And if I can't change, I'll leave voluntarily because I didn't come out here to hurt your little girls. So she went back and they had their meeting and they assigned somebody to watch me. Every move. And but in that week that we had before we started up the second half of the season, something miraculous happened in Alcoholics Anonymous, because two things had happened in the past. One thing, a guy in AA, I heard him say one night, he and his wife had these two girls that were incorrigible, 9 and 11 or 11 and 13 years old, and the kids were just out of, they would disobey, they fought, they skipped school, they left home, everything bad. They couldn't do anything, and the husband and wife are good AA members, and they can't figure out what to do. One night they came home, and they're trying to figure out how they're going to punish them again. And the wife walks through the door and she says, why don't we just treat them like little Alcoholics Anonymous members that walked into their first meeting. Why don't we just 12-step them? And so they changed their whole outlook and started 12-stepping these two little girls, and everything changed. The household settled down. Everything changed. And as a result of that, I took that and one other instance, and I went back to my Purple Panthers, and I started treating them like 13 little drunks that just walked into an AA meeting. When they strike out, I'd stop the game, and I'd go out and I'd hug them. And when they make an error in the outfield, I'd stop the game, and I'd go out and I'd kneel there. And they'd be trembling that I'm going to yell at them. And I'd go out and I'd tell them I loved them, and they couldn't do anything to make me upset with them. And that's what happened. And they never lost another game. And they played the other team in the championship game, and the Purple Panthers won 17-4, and they went to Shakey's, and I got my purple shirt on with my Panther and my purple hat up on the fireplace doing a can-can with the girls under each arm, hoping none of my customers walk in. And I just feel exhilarated. And what happened next was that the music ended and the girls went over and they got together and they said, 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate? The coaches. And I started to cry. And I held in my tears for 9 years in sobriety and I let the floodgates out. And that's what happened. And later that day, I stood there and I said, finally said to myself, I was sitting down there and I was sweating and I couldn't, something was coming over me. And I said, you know, I finally made amends to that little girl in Ethiopia by way of the 13 Purple Panthers, by extending unconditional love to them. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. Since then, I've had so many ups and downs in AA and in business and in life. My marriage broke up and I remarried about 5.5 years ago, and I have the most loving, kind wife. My daughters are so wonderful. One daughter just graduated from college on a softball scholarship after she'd been cut from the team as a freshman in high school. She went to pitching school. My other daughter, Lynn, was one of the Purple Panthers. And 3.5 years ago, I was asked to walk her down the aisle and give her away. And she and her husband are here tonight. And as I was dancing with her at the father-daughter dance or daughter-father dance, they played the music, The Wind Beneath My Wings, and she dedicated it to me. And I never knew. I never knew. I just came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I surrendered and surrendered and surrendered. And I surrender again and again every day. And by surrendering, my life is elevated, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous is for me that in which I live and move and have my being. And you people are the ones that enrich my life and give me everything I have. Thank you very much.